Results, but it says something fundamental that can be wrong with quantum systems. And we draw our inspiration from machine learning. So you know, this conference is machine learning for quantum design, and this is something like machine learning against quantum design. So it's a bit of an anti-talk, but I hope you will like it anyway. And there are many reasons why I chose a ladybug as my cover slide. In fact, I spent 2 hours crafting this slide. In the meantime, I was replying to my co-authors, you know, I'm swamped, like I can't reply to your questions right now. My PhD student was laughing next to me because I was looking at ladybugs. So first of all, my co-author is Nana Liu from Shanghai Jiao Tong University, and she has a penchant for wearing polka-dotted dresses, so I just wanted to acknowledge that. And you will see ladybugs throughout this talk. It's because what I'm telling you is actually quite depressing, and I just wanted to make it look cute, so you know, it's just easier to take it in. So let me tell you where the motivation is coming from. So you know, when we talk about machine learning, and particularly supervised machine learning, and we try to tell things apart, when we have a discrete number of things that we want to say something about, what we normally optimize for is generalization performance. So say we have a bunch of images of ants and cicadas, and we train some differentiable method with gradient descent to identify, you know, what makes an ant, and then what makes a cicada. And when we have a new instance, so that the orange dot, and it falls on one particular side of the hypersurface that decides which class is which, and with a high probability, you will get the correct class. So this is what we think about when we come up with a machine learning algorithm. So it's generalization performance, and we want to be robust against noise, but it's random noise that we have in mind. And when you look at the structure of what is actually happening in a classifier, you have some differentiable functions, say a neural network, and at the end of it, you threshold it. So, or you softmax, or you do something at the end to discretize it into bins. But until that point, everything is continuous and differentiable. So when you calculate the gradient descent, when you do the training, when you do the optimization, then you use this continuous valued function, and you just put on top this thresholding. So these are two things to keep in mind. Like normally, we only care about generalization performance, which considers a random noise. And there is a discretization step that's not part of the optimization. And a couple of years ago, people figured out that there's a problem. So if you have an image of a panda, and it's recognized by your machine learning algorithm as a panda, but you add very little noise to the extent that you cannot notice it by the naked eye, it can be entirely misclassified by the very same algorithm. And there's a method of constructing this adversarial noise. So this is no longer random noise. This is created to mislead your classifier. So the way you do it is you have access to the model, you have access to the gradient, how you train it, and based on that gradient, you can do a round of optimization to create this noise, this adversarial noise, to be close to have a minimum L2 norm. So the perturbation to the image will be minimal, and yet you throw off the classifier with very high accuracy. So initially, this particular neural network had a 57% confidence that, hey, this is a panda. And just by adding very little noise that doesn't really change the image to your eyes, and with a very, very high confidence, it predicts a completely different species. So this was new. And so initially, they thought that, hey, this has something to do with the norm, the L2 norm, that's what we are minimizing. But it's not true. So it's also true for any other norm. And for the human eye, it has like different perceptions. So depending on what you are optimizing for, you have slightly different perturbations to the image, but ideally all of them are imperceptible. Again, just by a visual recognition. And in this case, you know, we classify a cat as a traffic light. So there is something wrong here. So the early literature focused on on these like gradient-based attacks. So you had access to your neural network, and you had access to the gradient. So these were white box attacks because you knew what was inside the model. And based on those, you crafted this adversarial noise. So for the first 4 years of this phenomenon, people were focusing on the neural network models and the machine learning models, saying that there's something wrong with machine learning. It's, you know, that's what we have to fix. And it started an arms race, because it's a big problem. Because if you unleash self-driving cars on the streets and they start misrecognizing signs just by having a small perturbation to them, then you have a big problem. So one day, a new defense mechanism was invented. So, you know, there was some method of these guys in the gradient. And the next day, the defense was beaten by a new attack. So it just went on and on and on. Like every week, there was a new result with new defenses and then new attacks. And then people are saying, no, it's just neural networks that are susceptible to these attacks. If you use kernel methods, then you are not. That's not true. You can also attack kernel methods. So it turns out that this bug is actually fundamental. It has nothing to do with neural networks. It has nothing to do with machine learning. So what you see here is a different kind of attack. This is a black box attack, which doesn't know anything about the machine learning model. It can be anything. It can be a neural network. It can be a kernel method. It doesn't matter what you choose. You start with a random noise that is classified by something. It doesn't matter what it is. And you have a target image, say this ladybug. And just by querying the black box, by giving it these newer images, you can refine your noise into something that looks like the original image, and yet it is still misclassified. So this is a very strong indication that this is model independent. This has nothing to do with the model. So what it has to do with is the high-dimensional space and the strange counterintuitive geometry of high-dimensional space. So when we are in low dimensions, say in two dimensions, we have an idea what it means to be far. But it turns out that if you go to high dimensions, this intuition breaks down. And what happens is that, say, you have three classes, like red, green, and yellow dots in this image. In a high-dimensional space, there is actually a very high probability that in a small radius of, say, a red dot, you would have a green one. Even though the classes separate, and in principle they are far away, but because the concept of far away in a high-dimensional space is different, you will actually have an instance close to the class that you are trying to predict. But this is what I'm going to formalize later in the talk. So this also implies that now in quantum computing, we have a problem. So in machine learning, we work on high-dimensional real spaces, and so in supervised learning problems, we very often just map to a discrete set. So we have a differentiable architecture, and on top of that, we have thresholding, and that's what we are doing. But we very often do the same thing in quantum computing and in quantum protocols. Okay, in principle, you're doing some unitary that maps from some high-dimensional complex space to another high-dimensional complex space, but very often you measure things out and you threshold things, so you end up with discrete many things at the end of your calculations. So you are in a very, very, very similar scenario in many quantum computing protocols. And if the problem is with the high-dimensional space and not with the machine learning domain, then the results transfer to quantum computing. So this is what we show in this paper. So this is our setting. So our motivation very much came from machine learning, but we are interested in like what we can say about the security of quantum computers in a way that people really didn't think about before. Because, okay, so in quantum computing, you consider random noise or different kinds of noise models that say exist in these Niskayer devices. Then in quantum communication, you consider adversaries, or these adversaries perform certain kind of attacks. So this kind of vulnerability was really not considered before. So we can call it adversarial quantum learning, if you want to put a name to it, but it's actually not restricted to learning on quantum data. It actually applies to a very, very wide range of quantum protocols that have nothing to do with, say, quantum machine learning or quantum learning. So here are a couple of examples. So if you go to, say, quantum information theory, you very often think about witnesses. Say you want to craft a witness to tell whether a state is entangled or not. And when you actually sit down and derive a new witness, what you expect from that witness is that if you are on one side of the witness, so your prediction is entangled, then you are that sure that it's entangled. And if you are on the other side of the witness, then you may or may not be entangled. So the two classes are entangled and I don't know. And you cannot attack that scheme. You will see that there's an important assumption. You cannot attack this scheme. But the moment you start having some error rate in your witness, the moment, say, for instance, you learn this witness and you have, say, a 0.01% chance that that you don't do this classification correctly, then you can attack the scheme. Then you can think about phase transitions. So, you know, there's a body of literature by now on using machine learning in identifying phase transitions. So in many cases, you just run classical simulations to create quantum states, but you can also run quantum simulators and implement a quantum modus-abadis system on an actual quantum device and then study the correlations and various observables on this device and then do machine learning on that. Or it doesn't have to be machine learning. Like you can also just post-process it with some numerical method. And as long as there is some error rate, you can attack that scheme as well. Then you can also have, say, some noisy quantum channel that you are sending states across. And your task is at the end is to tell whether the quantum state was damaged in any way during this transition in the channel. Whether it's a normal state, well, that you're expecting, or there is some anomaly. So there are already a few papers on this. This scheme can also be attacked. And you can think of many other cases where there are discrete many things that you want to say about a quantum system. So all of these are sensitive to this type of attack. So what's safe? What's safe is, for instance, if you just do unitary evolution. That's fine, because you're not thresholding it. The thresholding that makes a big difference here. And so if you have a unitary or some CPTP map that maps from one high dimensional space to the other one, then Ullmann's theorem protects you because it, you know, these maps are contractive, so your fidelity cannot expand in a way that would sort of amplify the difference between the initial perturbation and the end of your map. So you can only contract, you can only decrease the difference between the initial state, the correct state, and the adversary perturbed state. So it's a big assumption. So that's necessary that you're only dealing with a discrete number of things, and it's also necessary that you have a non-zero error rate. So we have two scenarios in mind. So we think of a protocol in general as, you know, some quantum state preparation, followed by some unitary evolution or some CPTP map. And after that, you're doing some thresholding stuff to get these discrete many outputs, you know, entangled or not, whether you have non-local correlations or local correlations and so on. And we can divide it into two parts where Bob, your adversary, attacks the scheme. You can either attack the state preparation part and perturb the input state to your quantum device, or you attack the quantum device itself, and instead, say, some unitary or some CPTP map, you execute some other one with some a small perturbation to throw you off. The two are mathematically very similar, so I'm going to just focus on the first case, when the state preparation is delegated to an untrusted Bob, and he can perform these adversarial attacks. So, let me introduce a couple of notions for the high dimensional space. So now we assume that your quantum states are distributed according to some probability distribution P. This can be high random, you name it, it doesn't matter. The next thing that we need is the error rate. So I told you that if your entanglement witness is perfect, then it cannot be attacked. But the moment you have a non-zero error rate, then you are vulnerable to attacks. So this is our main assumption. So as long as you have non-zero error rate in whatever scheme you have, you can attack. And if you are coming from a machine learning background, then what we call here the error rate, this is the generalization error. So this is typically what machine learning tries to decrease by adding regularization terms and being clever about the architecture and so on. And what you typically have access to is empirical error. So based on the empirical error and some regularization term, we want to decrease generalization performance. So, but for us, it doesn't matter because as long as your generalization error is non-zero, as long as you have any error rate in the full distribution, your scheme is vulnerable to an attack. Now, we define epsilon adversaries, which are close to this misclassified set. So if within an epsilon radius of a point of your distribution, you are in the misclassified set, you can be in a misclassified set, that means that there exists an adversary example. I'm not telling you how to find it. All I'm saying is that there exists one and it can be found one way or the other. So what we are going to create is the epsilon expansion of our misclassified set. So we create this this set which creates this epsilon radius around every single point in your misclassified set. It doesn't have to be a connected set. So your misclassified instances can be all over the space, but it can also be a connected space. We don't really care. It doesn't matter. The topology doesn't matter. So you create the epsilon expansion of this set, and what we are going to estimate is how big is this set. Because M epsilon is going to tell you this is all the set where there can be adversaries within a small distance. So if you say something about the size of this set relative to the entire distribution, then you can estimate of what's the chance of being attacked. And what we are going to see that the measure of this set scales with dimension. And this is why you can attack machine learning models, and this is why you can attack many quantum computing schemes. Yep?
I mean, one of the features underlying the adversarial attacks you described before was that what you trained on was actually a submanifold.
Yep.
And so, it's partially an issue of manifold learning. The adversarial attacks took you off the manifold, and that was, you couldn't generalize because you'd never seen data like that before.
That's right. Yeah. You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. The main and we tried to go down that route, and you're right. You can make a manifold argument as well, and then you can bring in tools from differential geometry to understand the manifold and make statements about that. And when you abstract away from that and you only use measures and topology, you are giving something away. But what you are getting is bounds. Upper and lower bounds, and that's what we are after, because that's enough for us to show that the probability increases very fast of finding an adversary. So that will be a next stage of, let's go back to the geometry, study the distribution, and that's going to be one of my open questions. But initially, we realized that it's enough to look at topology and make like measure theoretical statements. Okay, so. The one more thing we need is a concentration function. It's very commonly used in quantum information theory. It comes up all the time, but somehow it wasn't used in this sense. So now imagine that you have some sigma hat subset within some space, and we want to study its epsilon expansion. So now if your sigma hat has at least measure 1/2, then we want to see like what's the minimum size of the epsilon expansion of this set. Okay? This is an important concept to understand. So if your space is concentrated, that means that your epsilon expansion of this set covers almost the entire space. That means that after the minus sign in the definition is that you have something close to 1, and the 1 minus 1 is going to be close to 0. On the other hand, if your space is anti-concentrated, That means that by adding an epsilon margin to your set, like this new set, the epsilon expansion set, is hardly bigger than 1/2. That means that you are going, that this concentration of a function is going to give you something close to 1/2. So I'm not saying that, this doesn't mean that your error rate, you know, the M set here, yeah, this set has to be 1/2. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying that the concentration function allows you to say something about the structure of the space in a measure theoretical terms. However, scales the actual measure of M and M epsilon, that's a different story. We just need this theoretical tool, the concentration function. And we know that there are various families of concentration functions that tell you about how your measure, how this concentration function scales with dimensions or other properties of your space. And one particular family is called the normal Levy family. In this family, you have an exponential decay with the number of dimensions. So you get close to zero very, very fast. That means that your space is very concentrated. So you can increase the dimension, and just by adding a little bit of epsilon to some set of measure 1/2, you are covering the entire space. And so what we are showing is that when you work in SUD, when you talk about unitaries, that's actually like when you work with the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, and you pick your unitaries with a hard random measure, then what you have is actually a normal Levy family, which means that with the number of dimensions of your unitaries, which is sort of equivalent to state preparation in this case, because you can just start with the vacuum state and think about the state preparation protocol as a unitary, then you are vulnerable to these attacks. So your space is actually concentrated, so you are very much exposed to this sort of attack. So it becomes more and more difficult to certify whether your untrusted Bob perturbs your state. And now we have this big tension, and this is the main thesis of the paper. So on one hand, we want to build quantum computers and larger and larger quantum computers to exploit, you know, the large Hilbert spaces that they can operate on. On the other hand, the resource use of verifying whether somebody did an adversary or perturbation to your calculations scales extremely bad. So it becomes very difficult to be robust against these attacks. And like this is how bad it is. Here you have, well, this doesn't really work, but you can see that the number of states, the number of copies required from the state preparation protocol scales quadratically in the number of dimension. But not quadratically, but to the power of 4. This is about quadratically worse than tomography. So you actually need more resources to verify whether your state was perturbed than you would need for tomography. So this is becoming very expensive very fast. So this is a fundamental trade-off that in the general case you can't really do anything against. And well, this is bad for a number of reasons. So I already mentioned a few scenarios, and then you can think of quantum learning. So in quantum learning, we work on quantum data, and our output is typically also some quantum state. Then you can think about quantum template matching, where you have two template states, and then you have to tell that a new state is closer to one template or the other one. You can also think about quantum anomaly detection when you have to say, you know, whether the state is a normal state, something that fulfills your expectations or lies out in some unspecified domain. So in this second protocol, in this quantum anomaly detection, you need a controlled swap operation for comparison. And like if you delegate the preparation of this gate to an untrusted device, then you end up with this dependence on dimensionality, so it becomes very, very difficult to certify whether your anomaly detection scheme can work at all. So it's again, it's, very, very bad for studying, say, phase transitions. There are mainly three ways of doing it. So One is that, say, you have some classical numerical algorithm for simulating the quantum system, say, finding the ground state, and then you apply some classical machine learning or classical heuristic to identify the transition point. The second one is, you know, apply classical machine learning on data coming from a quantum computer. There was a new result on this just a couple of weeks ago. And then you can also have like just imperfect post-processing of data coming from an experimental device, like no learning at all, just generic numerical imprecision. So all of these schemes can be attacked because your space is very high dimensional, and if you delegate your state preparation or you don't trust your device, then you run into this problem. And you can think about imperfect witnesses for entanglement and say non-local correlations, particularly when you learn these witnesses, when you learn the classifiers. And so my conclusion is, you know, beware of the bug. And this is fundamental. It's actually just that, just people didn't consider this vulnerability before. And another question is, you know, given that this concentration of measure phenomenon makes our quantum systems vulnerable to an entire new family of attacks, like what else can we say? We studied a bit the continuous variable setting. You know, you have infinite dimensional spaces, so it would be very strange that they would be infinitely prone to these attacks. That's not true. So they also have a scaling, and that scaling is bad, but it's like not as bad as what the infinite dimensional Hilbert space would imply. But what we have not studied before, and then this goes back to the question that we had earlier, like what is beyond SUD? So at the moment, we are just picking like hard random unitaries from SUD. But there's a lot more to say here. So if you start talking about manifolds, if you start talking about geometry, you might be able to identify subclasses within SUD which are more robust against these attacks and say they are not so vulnerable or they are not so bad to certify after an attack. And that's pretty much what I had to say. If you are interested in these foundational questions, we will have a conference dedicated exactly to this a year from now in Banff. So it will look at like statistical learning theory and quantum physics, how they interact, and we want to address like foundational questions when you bring together these two. So let me know if you are interested in that topic. And I'm only here today, so if you would like to talk to me and you want to tell me how bad this paper is, then catch me today. Thank you.
Okay, we have lots of time for questions.
Hi, Pete. Thank you for the nice talk. So I have a question about the band you obtained is for both white box attack and black box attack, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. matter, right?
Yeah.
So my question is that if we know, if we suppose that it is a black box attack, mm-hmm. can we get a better upper band?
So the main difference between black box attacks and white box attacks that from the perspective of the adversary, white box attacks are easier to craft. Because then, like the moment you have access to the gradient, so you have access to the gradient of a variational circuit, then you can immediately create an adversary, an adversarial example. You can inject bad noise. Whereas with the black box attack, when you go back to this scheme where we have the ladybox constructed, what I did not put here is how many thousands of calls you require. So here you needed about 100,000 calls until you got to the stage where you could identify when it looked like the ladybug. So when it comes to a quantum device, like it's an open question really, how many calls to the device you would need in a black box setting. I don't know for sure. If you have access to the gradient of say a variational circuit, it's easy to construct. But like a black box attack on a quantum device, I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Sorry, I'm just using the intuitive picture idea, but maybe, and I know infinite dimensional space or large spaces are very slippery, but Couldn't you do the same construction the other way around? Since like what you misclassify and what you classify correctly is something that's very swappable, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's changing the classes. And then you could say, I make an epsilon bound around the space of what's correctly classified, and I could run through exactly the same argument saying this is like a very large measure in high dimensional spaces, and then you could say exactly the opposite. Can you tell me why this is not possible?
I don't see why it would work in the reverse way, because what you are saying is that there are adversaries all over the space. Like I don't know how you would flip that argument around.
No, you kind of, instead of like seeing like if the space of misclassified examples grows,
yeah,
you could also flip it around and say like, I want to say the space in which I'm safe, how does it grow? But I don't see why the mathematics should be different, so I don't see why the results should be different.
Okay. I think the main thing is that we don't tell you how to find these adversarial examples, because the result is only says that, yes, there are adversarial examples all over the space, or they don't tell you how. So yes, you know, like the correct results are also dense. The correct classification is also all over the place. What we are saying that there are always adversaries nearby. So yes, finding a correct classifier is relatively simple, and you will get it with a high probability. But that's not what we are saying.
Sorry, what's like an example of an adversary attack on quantum computers?
We haven't done yet. One yet. So this is just an existence proof. So that's what we are interested in: whether the same results translate to quantum computers. And the answer is yes. And now it's up to the community to create one attack. Although I'm really keen on attacking phase transitions, what my co-author Nana said, like, who would want to attack a problem where you want to identify the phase transition? And I'm like, I don't know, but it's a fun problem.
You keep talking like that, they aren't going to let you into the lab. So with the exponential growth of the system means that the vulnerability to attack grows. But it also feels like the vast majority of these attacks would have to be enacted by basically an arbitrary unitary on the space, so themselves would become kind of arbitrarily hard to implement. Is that, how would you even perform this attack in the vast majority of cases if it's just some random rotation in Hilbert space?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So this is why it's important that, you only consider the hard random case. And you're absolutely right. This might not be the right scenario, since the actual unitaries that we can implement are much more restricted. And so the next meaningful paper would be to talk about, say, hey, these are the variational circuits that are efficient to implement today. What's the manifold of these? Can we attack these? Can we devise defense schemes for these? Yeah, this is the next step. I'm glad I left time for the questions.
I think this is related to the last question, but I'm not sure. So the high dimensional space you're talking about in terms of what the adversary has to manipulate is the full number of parameters that are used, say for the machine learning context, the total number of parameters in your neural network or whatever. The number of, but those parameters will include presumably a huge number of irrelevant parameters.
Actually, this is wrong. It's not the number of parameters. It's the number of dimensions of the space where you have your data instances. That's what matters.
It's the target dimension.
So this is very important. So when people started this research, right, the initial wave of research on these attacks focused on the model, they said that there's something wrong with the parameters. The parameter space is too high dimensional, and we are only searching it with gradient descent. So what do we expect? But the answer is no. It's not the model parameters that matters. It's the original space where your data instances lie. Same story in the quantum case. Ooh.
I have a very related question. So this is maybe my misunderstanding about the mathematical state. So the measure concentration is a well-established fact,
yeah.
Measure concentration in high dimension. When we apply this to a classification problem, the relevant dimension that we're talking about is the input dimension, right?
Yeah, that's right.
However, the classifier does some pre-processing, where usually I would go from the high dimension to a lower dimension for like down to maybe two in case of binary classification.
Yeah.
And the important thing is, or the important instance, vector representation of the input is the one at the penultimate layer of the network, right? Because the final layer of the network is the classification layer. So when we look at these visualizations, you know, just intuitive pictures, the one that you have shown on the first slide, when we have several instances that represent the data points, like these dots, and then we have a boundary separating them, this is slightly misleading, I think, because it does mix different spaces.
So
the space that I would be talking about, actually, for the classifier, is not really high dimensional. So where I see the issue is that I can have a tiny perturbation in the input. That's true. This is the hallmark of adversarial examples, right?
That's right.
However, it's not a tiny step in the input space. It can be, or it is obviously, in the vulnerable network, amplified by the whole process of the transformations when data goes through the network. And so when I plot the space of extracted features or the feature vectors, say the output of the penultimate layer, yeah, before the classifier, it's going to be an entirely different space, and it's not high dimensional.
It's part of your model. And what's very important is that, you know, people for many years thought that there is this amplification going on, and it's not true. Because if you implement, say, a unitary neural network, like completely classical unitary neural network, that's also sensitive to attacks. So amplification here in this case doesn't matter. What matters is that there will be some difference also in this penultimate layer that you eventually threshold. And because you are thresholding, that change at the penultimate layer with the thresholding is what causes the sensitivity to perturbations. So eventually the problem is that you are starting from this high dimensional space, and that doesn't have to be an amplification happening in the middle. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We have lunch now until 2 p.m.
Thank you.